As I was getting ready to come to Los Angeles this week, you know, hurtle through the air in an aluminum tube with hundreds of strangers, I was thinking about travel the way a lot of people do. It's fine. It'll get me there. I'll probably eat an overpriced soggy sandwich. I had no idea that a passenger experience gone brutally wrong would turn into a national conversation and wipe millions of dollars from a company's value. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. That's exactly what flying is, an entire economic model built on fuel costs, overhead, union agreements, computer systems, meeting your life, something you might experience with your elbow fighting another person. So we're going to get into getting from here to there today from lots of different angles, plus a little politics, both domestic and international, some tech, some religion, and the idea that a company could microchip you. Yes, really. As always, come talk to me or the staff at marketplace.org or on Twitter. We're at marketplace WKND. And some of you did get in touch with us. You wrote, you tweeted, you called to tell us what you love, or okay, it was really mostly hate about air travel.
I just want to say one of my biggest fundamental pet peeves about air travel is actually food prices at the airport. Just because we're checked into security and we kind of have us trapped doesn't mean that you can mark up fast food prices.
My biggest pet peeve is people who put their hair over the back of their headrest so that it covers your TV screen, and the people who put their feet on the armrest. It's so gross. I don't understand it.
I would say the worst part about traveling are the crowds. When you're in an airplane, you're with 300 or whatever of your most favorite strangers, and there's no avoiding them.
I am 6 feet tall, and the one thing I hate the most about flying is not knowing whether or not the person in front of me is going to put their seat back. Oh my God, can we just all collectively agree that we're not going to put our seat back?
I was traveling with my oldest son, his first time flying solo with daddy, and I was just dreading the entire trip. And as soon as we got there, he was so excited and so happy just to be there. And his excitement over that really made me remember that it's really exciting, this flying business.
That was Brad from San Jose, Jessica from Los Angeles, Noah from Phoenix, Claire from Palo Alto, and Tom from Albany. There was much more we didn't have time to include. A lot of you wrote to say you feel like cattle herded on and off the plane, or that there never seems to be enough overhead storage space. And then there's the basic psychological frustration of flying, that you have given up control over your life to someone else. But as infuriating as flying can be for travelers, there's a whole other host of concerns for the people who work in the industry. Sarah Nelson is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants. She's been in the business 20 years. She is a United Airlines flight attendant, but we didn't bring her on to focus on the specific incident this week, more to talk about what she sees from her side of the aisle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What don't people understand about your job?
People don't understand that flight attendants are there for the safety, health, and security of everyone on board, and that today, with seats closer together than ever and staffings at minimums, we have a harder job than ever keeping order. One of the biggest things that we have to do on board is de-escalate conflict, because when you simply get that many people packed together, those conflicts arise very easily.
You have been doing this for a long time. How has the industry changed? And how is the way you do your job or you're treated changed?
The industry has changed incredibly because with all of the cost cuts after 9/11, cutting back the staffing and trying to get every single seat filled so that the airlines can make money, it has really changed the flying experience, and it has made it more challenging for us than ever. And it's one of the reasons that we fought so hard to make sure that cell phone calls could not be made on planes. There are too many annoyances today being packed in so closely together. And just even one little thing to add to that can really create an atmosphere where people can lose it. You know, that's very difficult to deal with. I will tell you, though, that this is a great job and we love flying. And flight attendants don't do this because we don't like people. We actually do this because we're good at our jobs in interacting with people.
Do you see your job as a customer service job?
We see our job first and foremost as aviation's first responders. That is our primary reason for being there. Since 9/11, our jobs changed from just being first responders in the event of any safety or health emergency to also being the last line of defense in aviation security. Mm. So these are at the forefront of our mind as we're greeting people with a smile, frankly, and trying to be good hosts. But we are constantly are at the forefront of our minds, making sure that that flight is secure and looking out for any potential safety incidents. And we do that the whole time that we are doing things that other people perceive as oftentimes just being service items.
If you could wave a magic wand and change one thing about air travel or the way you do your job, what would it be?
It would be to have more staffing for flight attendants so that we can go back to the days when we truly feel like we have enough time and ability to take care of everyone on board. And we do that today, but not with the same ability as when we had more people on board to take care of those passengers.
Sarah Nelson, International President of the Association of Flight Attendants, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
After the United incident was broadcast around the world and a weather-related mess in Atlanta caused a huge backup for Delta, a lot of people have been wondering, what is up with flying lately? Has it always felt like this? Is it worse? What's going on? So we turned to an expert. Henry Hartevelt has worked for airlines, and now he analyzes them as president of Atmosphere Research Group. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you very much.
You know, I wonder if there's a disconnect, and I'd like you to explain this a little bit, between the way Americans think of airlines, which is I pay a price, I get on a plane, and the airline gets me somewhere, to what the airlines are thinking in terms of how they run their business and make their margins.
So if you talk to an airline executive, they will tell you that they are an industrial company in the transportation business. But we as passengers look at airlines as service businesses, so there's a disconnect there. The other problem is that as passengers, we don't really know what rights we have, and the contracts of carriage that none of us ever read, and which can be hundreds, perhaps even 1,000 or more pages, aren't very clear, and they're not easy for us to obtain. The truth is that as passengers, we have very few rights.
I think of the reaction that this has generated, and my Twitter lit up with stories of, I can't fit my bag in the overhead thing, they nickel and dime me for this, that, and the other thing, air travel is just a complete nightmare. Is it worse, or do we just think it's worse because we all have phones and we all have the ability to write about whatever indignity has been foisted on us that day?
Objectively, air travel is better. There are more flights operating on time, the airlines are losing less luggage, and ironically, in light of this story, they're bumping fewer passengers than they were in years past. And they had an excellent year for safety, and air travel continues to be a financial bargain. But the experience is suffering. The airlines have removed amenities, they've taken away our legroom, and they do a pretty good job of taking away our dignity as travelers.
Tell me a little bit about the back end of some of this, because we look at, say, what happened to Delta, and, you know, weather in Atlanta can cause a nightmare all over the world. We have a very different system than we had even 20 years ago. In terms of consolidation and mergers, does that play a role in any of this?
Yes. So right now, the four largest airlines, American, Delta, Southwest, and United, control approximately 83 or 85% of U.S. airline capacity compared to 20 years ago when we had a far larger number of big airlines out there, but each with a smaller share of the market. Now, the airline industry is intensely competitive. Our research shows that every year, fewer and fewer people say they're loyal to a particular airline, meaning that they're making up their choice trip to trip every time they fly. But the fact that there are fewer options, I think in some airline executives means they don't have to try as hard. The truth is they have to try harder because at some point people are simply going to say, I won't fly, I'll drive where I'm going, or I'll look into Amtrak.
There were rules that the Department of Transportation put into place during the Obama administration that were aimed at sort of transparency. So, you know, if an airline's going to include the price of different things in your ticket, they got to tell you. Do you see this presidential administration changing at all the way we experience air travel?
The administration actually has a very good Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, who has worked at the DOT before and has been a board member at Northwest Airlines, which is now, Northwest is now part of Delta. So I think she understands the airline industry very, very well. I think that the Trump administration has said that they want to be a more business-friendly administration than past administrations have been. And so I think some of the measures that were proposed under the Obama administration will either not be implemented or will be reexamined for possible rollback. From the consumer protection standpoint, the Trump administration will probably not be one that advances consumer protections that much. My hope is that they just don't gut the few remaining protections that exist.
Henry Hardeveld, president of Atmosphere Research Group, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
If you know Marketplace, you know we love our numbers. It's kind of our signature thing. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Sarah.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
$1,750.
That's how much money competitive eater Matt Stoney made eating marshmallow peeps at the World Peeps Eating Championship in National Harbor, Maryland. A world record.
Americans will spend about $2.6 billion on Easter candy this year, which is a lot of sugar and a lot of calories.
According to Consumer Reports, 3.5 peeps make up a 100-calorie serving.
Stoney ate 255 peeps in just 5 minutes, which, if you do the math, is about 7,285 calories.
Disgusting.
Delicious. $700 million.
That's how much the Rams increased their value by moving their football team from St. Louis to Los Angeles.
At least that's what the city of St. Louis said in a lawsuit filed against the NFL this week.
The city, the Regional Stadium Authority, and others are seeking damages, saying the Rams didn't make an obligatory good faith effort to stick around.
St. Louis says it poured hundreds of millions into the team, including fundraising for a brand new stadium, all for nothing. $50.
That's how much a ticket to Coachella cost back in 1999, its very first year.
It debuted as a one-day music festival. Only 25,000 people showed up, and promoters lost about $800,000.
For this year's event, which kicks off this weekend, tickets cost $399 and sold out in 3 hours.
When you add in fees for camping or glamping, the weekend could run you anywhere from $500 to $7,500.
Meanwhile, I'll be spending my weekend making flower crowns and listening to Radiohead at home.
From the numbers to the news now, with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. We brought in two guests to analyze the news and what to watch for. Natalie Kitroff, economy reporter for the LA Times, and Jillian White, senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks.
Hey, Lizzie.
I want to start, Natalie, with you, because we're in Los Angeles. We're sitting in the same studio, and you are long a Los Angeles-y thing. Tell me about your long.
So I am long on media unions. I'm long because right now there's a strike that is hovering over Hollywood. The WGA has...
The Writers Guild of America?
That's right. They've asked their members to authorize a strike, and... reports suggest that's likely. The WGA East, the Eastern branch of the union, has also been on just a tear unionizing digital media companies across the board. Huffington Post, Gawker, now Gizmodo. This is surprising, but it's sort of picking up speed, and it's also happening at a time when the fight for 15 also gathered a lot of momentum. You know, we'll see if it's here to stay, but there certainly seems to be a lot of activity there.
What would a strike mean in terms of the entertainment and media output that, you know, consumers use?
Well, the last strike, there was a huge economic impact, billions of dollars. The studios kind of ground to a halt. That was back in 2007. So there's a lot of fear here around the potential economic impact. It's unclear, of course, you know, that they still have until May 1st to sort of reach an agreement. But there is a potentially huge economic impact in this city where, you know, a lot of the economy revolves around Hollywood.
As much as it's kind of a surprising thing, it almost seems, when you think about the larger context around media organizations, I guess a little bit less surprising in this moment. A lot of journalists aren't paid super, super well or super highly. And additionally, it's a consolidating industry. And I think when you have those two things and you have workers who feel particularly vulnerable or who feel vulnerable to being underpaid and feel like they don't maybe have a lot of power when it comes to not just wages, but, you know, benefits and the ability to insulate themselves from lawsuits and lots of different types of things. I guess in that context, to me, sometimes it doesn't seem so surprising that this wave is happening now.
Yeah. I want to turn a little bit, Jillian, to your long, because we're talking about economics and economic disruptions. And boy, it's been an interesting time. So tell me about your long.
Yeah, so I'm long on Trump's economic flip-flops. And I'm sure no one will be super surprised by this, but during the past week, President Trump gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal, and during that interview, he did pretty much a complete 180 on a couple of pretty big topics. So, for instance, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, it wasn't so long ago that President Trump called the organization obsolete. Mm-hmm. This week, in what was perhaps the most direct of his reversals, he said that it was no longer obsolete, that he thought it was pretty important. That was not it. Currency manipulation is another one that's been a favorite topic of Trump's. In the past, when he's talked about the U.S. dollar being too strong, he said that the strong dollar makes it harder to compete in foreign markets, especially when countries like China are manipulating their currency to keep it artificially low. At one point, he said that one of his first tasks in office was going to be to label China a currency manipulator. He apparently does not believe that anymore and actually said that the reason the dollar is too strong is because people have such an outsized faith in him. And he even switched gears when it comes to Fed chairperson Yellen. He's been heavily critical of the Fed and at one point has been quoted saying that he would probably replace her at the end of her term. As of this week, he says that he has a tremendous amount of respect for her and he would keep the door open to leaving her in that post in the future. So just a lot of reversals in a pretty short period of time.
And I assume you're going long on this because you're looking at the potential for many more reversals.
Absolutely. I think this is something that's going to continue to happen, both, you know, to kind of fit the message that Trump wants to put forward, to fit in with what his advisors are telling him. And then also, just because I think at certain points in time, it was unclear to people why he was taking such a strong and contrarian stance. And I think some of these reversals are just him kind of coming back in line with consensus.
I want to point to something else about these statements, though. It is fairly extraordinary to have a sitting U.S. president comment on the strength or weakness of the dollar. I mean, that's generally a no-no.
What's interesting about this president is that he's made clear that part of his strategy as a businessman and now a politician is to be unpredictable. Hmm. You know, he listens for 10 minutes to someone and he changes his mind. And whether you believe that narrative or not, he has definitely held true to one thing, which is being unpredictable. And that is not something that markets love.
Jillian, I want to stay with you and go with your short.
So I am short on public housing improvements. So This past week, the new HUD secretary, Ben Carson, who everyone may remember from the actual election, went to visit a Miami housing development and he got stuck in an elevator. And while that's a pretty funny image, the truth is public housing and subsidized housing programs are plagued with lots of issues. So just talking about mechanical failures for a second, recently a 42-year-old woman named Shantae Ellis died in Kingsbury Towers in Trenton of cardiac arrest. So someone had called 911 to get her some medical assistance. EMS arrived, and it took them a really long time to get up to her 15th floor apartment because one of the elevators doesn't work. So that's kind of a not funny angle to what was kind of seen as a humorous outtake for Carson. So all of this to say, Ben Carson just experienced one seemingly minor inconvenience, but there could be a lot more of those soon. HUD stands to lose around $6 billion under the Trump administration.
But you don't think that, say, having the HUD secretary stuck in an elevator might spur policymakers to say, wait a minute, why is public housing infrastructure in such a state that something like that happens? You think they look at it as a one-off?
I think they look at it as a one-off, and I think Carson has been incredibly conservative in the way that he talks about public housing and the funding that goes to it. I mean, part of it is that he has said that these cuts will be made up for in infrastructure spending, but there's really no concrete plan for what that would look like. And there's actually no concrete plan for the infrastructure bill, period.
I want to pivot to your short, Natalie, because we're talking about sort of public infrastructure in the United States, but you are short, I guess we should say, a person who controls the public infrastructure and public purse of another country. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm short on Nicolas Maduro, you know, who's running Venezuela right now, but is in a really precarious position, like the rest of the country's economy. It's sort of been a nightmare situation for a while now, but it seems to be coming to a head. Protests have built for 2 weeks. People are hungry because inflation has been going up. And this is sort of tied to the broader economic dilemma that Maduro faces. The country owes a lot. There's a huge national debt. It's sort of teetering on the edge of default. But as he continues to make these payments and the cash reserves get tighter and tighter, the country sort of spirals more and more into crisis. The highest court in the land voted to annul Congress. Maduro then had to reverse that. That was seen as a really anti-democratic move. It was also a sign that Maduro responds to outside pressure. This is a long-term short. I'm not saying Maduro is leaving tomorrow, but he is facing a situation that he hasn't for a couple of years now, since 2014. These are sort of seen as the most aggressive protests since then.
I'm also of the mind that when you look at how much the country has been spiraling out of control, how bad some of the people there are faring, it's hard to believe that things haven't gotten to a tipping point yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to be short on Maduro, right? Like, this is not a very controversial short. It's more interesting to ask, why hasn't the rest of the country been short on him sooner? It remains to be seen.
Natalie Kitcheriff from the LA Times, Jillian White from The Atlantic. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you.
No doubt you are hearing and reading a lot about Russia these days. Negotiations with the U.S. government, involvement in Syria, and, of course, the questions about our election. President Trump himself has taken a relatively harsher tone toward Russia, but this is an incredibly complicated geopolitical and economic relationship. So how to think about all of it? Matthew Rojanski is director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So let's say you're in the White House. What are you thinking slash doing towards Russia in this coming week?
Well, you know, challenge number one with Russia, and there are, of course, many, many challenges. The president said that the relationship is, you know, at the worst point that it's been. And I think that that's true.
I assume we mean accepting the Cold War.
Correct. Right. Okay. But I think it's fair to say that there are aspects of the situation today that are worse than, you know, some of the Cold War years. Certainly, you know, Gorbachev was a lot friendlier than Putin is now. And so we are dealing definitely with a very challenging authoritarian, revanchist, but also expansionist Russia that has learned to throw its weight around globally. And so I think the challenge in the coming week is the same as the underlying challenge all along, which is, look, this is a country we can't go to war with, because the reality of a direct conflict between the United States and Russia is that it destroys the world. These are the world's two largest nuclear powers. Russia is the only country that has the ability to destroy life as we know it in the United States in under an hour. So we have to find ways in which we can work with these folks talk to them about the hard issues, which now includes, of course, our disagreements over Ukraine, but also Syria, maybe North Korea, where they may be able to be helpful, maybe not. And then there are some areas where we have, broadly speaking, some common interests, like counterterrorism. It doesn't make sense that we wouldn't be able to cooperate in that area, and yet it's very hard.
Well, is this a relationship where we're talking about pressure or inducements or some, you know, mixed basket of both?
Well, every relationship requires a carrot and a stick. We've had a lot of stick, or we've at least had the word stick. We've talked about pressure on Russia. But what hasn't happened is we haven't really moved Russia in terms of its policies at all in the last 3 years that we've had sanctions in place. That doesn't mean that you turn around and you offer only inducements, only, you know, positive incentives. I think you have to maintain pressure. But I think one of the things that the Russians are waiting to see is a signal of American seriousness, both in terms of toughness and resolve. So, for instance, we are now striking the Assad regime, which is something we haven't done until now, but we're still striking ISIS. That's good. That is definitely a kind of stronger platform from which to try to negotiate with the Russians. But the immediate objection that the Russians raised in the Tillerson-Lavrov summit was, okay, so what's your long-term vision for Syria? And that has been a real challenge for the United States, across both administrations thus far. We need to develop a very serious, very clear vision for where we want Syria to go and demonstrate seriousness of purpose there. And then I think the Russians will take us seriously.
I'm going to paraphrase the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who was caught at a diplomatic summit saying, why should U.S. taxpayers be interested in Ukraine? I want to pivot that gaffe, if you want to call it that, a little bit to the idea of why should a regular American be focused on this right now? How should, you know, someone at their dinner table try to make sense of what our relationship is with Russia right now?
The trick with Russia is that we have a whole lot of other interests at stake with Russia. Russia is not North Korea, right? This is not a country that we can simply say, well, there's just this one issue. We can isolate them over that issue. We can sanction them over that issue, and we can wait out the regime. The problem is we've got to deal with Russia on nuclear. We've got to deal with them on counterterrorism and counterproliferation of all kinds of WMD, including chemical weapons, and that's recently been an issue in Syria again. And we've got to deal with them on our bilateral relationship, right? I mean, this is the world's largest country. People forget, by the way, Russia is our third closest neighbor. I have a colleague at the Wilson Center who says the United States borders on Mexico, Canada, and fish. But, third or fourth on that list, 3 miles away between Alaska and Chukotka, there's Russia.
I don't want to be alarmist in rhetoric, but I'm curious, like, at what point are we talking about, you know, Cold War politics again?
Well, I mean, we hear echoes of the Cold War, I think, in the way that a lot of Russians and Americans have talked about one another over the last several years. I think the panic and the paranoia about, you know, who spoke to the Russian ambassador when, obviously I understand the context is a concern about Russian meddling in the American election, which is absolutely problematic.
Yeah.
And is being investigated. But, you know, look, I've talked to the Russian ambassador. You got to talk to the Russian ambassador. He's the ambassador of the world's biggest country. I think we need to balance between clear-eyed recognition that these people are not our friends. We are not in a friendly relationship. We are in a conflict with Russia. It's not a military conflict. So the other side of that balance is let's keep it not a military conflict. And so I think it's good. One of the results of the Tillerson-Putin meeting was Putin signaling that he will go back to the air safety agreement over Syria. The agreement's sort of more a technicality than anything, but it's a signal of Russia's intent not to do the kind of provocations, the kind of near misses in the air, at sea. This stuff is incredibly dangerous, not because we wouldn't understand that it's an accident. Sure, we would understand it's an accident, but we're still going to have to go on high alert. The Russians are going to go on high alert. And again, remember, these are the world's two biggest nuclear powers. That's not a cliff you want to walk too close to.
Matt Rojanski, director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. As always, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Last week, we brought you stories from Corvallis, Oregon, a college town that's trying to turn itself into a startup hub. Doing that is harder than it looks, but Corvallis is not the only city trying. Over the next 2 weeks, our sister show, Marketplace Tech, is running a series on tech hubs. What works, what doesn't, and what the future holds for tech-friendly cities. Host Ben Johnson joins me from Phoenix, or should I say the Silicon Desert? No, actually, I'm not going to say that. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So tell me a little bit about what a, you know, nascent tech hub looks and feels like.
Yeah, so in the past year or so, I've been to a lot of cities that believe they are or would like to be the next big tech hub, whether it's Kansas City, Durham, North Carolina, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, here in Phoenix this week. They all look and feel very different, but they've all got a lot of boosters in local government, local entrepreneurs who want to make their companies and their cities great, and a lot of energy. Usually that energy is around building new things, whether we're talking about building apps or physical spaces in neighborhoods that feed into creating the kind of community that maybe someday creates the next billion-dollar company.
You're describing a lot of commonalities, but I imagine there are other ingredients that help go from sort of, we want to be a tech hub, to, hey, we're successfully doing this.
Totally. A lot of it feels like trying to catch lightning in a bottle, but we started to get a sense of basically like three common ingredients. So government support, not just for like ribbon cutting ceremonies, but when it comes to regulation, collaboration, and policy. This can mean tax breaks for moving your company downtown. It can mean allowing for testing of self-driving cars, for instance, that they've been doing here in Phoenix. You also need access to venture capital. This is one of the really challenging ingredients because the vast majority of VC money is just simply in Boston, New York, and Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And then I would also say homegrown talent is also really important. And that usually comes from local universities and colleges that kind of have to be around in order for that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that we saw in Corvallis. They're trying to build a lot of this stuff around Oregon State. So shifting to Phoenix, where you are, what's it like? How is it doing on this list of metrics that it takes to, you know, make this happen?
Phoenix is a really big city already. There's solar happening here. You, I'm sure, have heard of the company GoDaddy. That is based here, the website building company. Another ingredient that I think is really important is these aspiring tech hubs need to be a place where talent wants to be or wants to stay, Lizzie. Because in the tech world, there's a ton of competition for talent, as you know. So either a city needs to attract talent by being known as a great place to live, or it needs to have enough going on that local people aren't just going to try to get to a bigger, better tech hub somewhere else. So Lizzie, this week we went to meet and see a bunch of Arizona State University students actually pitch startup projects in an entrepreneurship class, and I can play some tape from that.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome class time.
But we are Student Solutions, and welcome to the future of the way college works and the way that we interact with class time.
This was a class of, I think, around 100 students. They're all broken out into teams, and they all had their own startups that they were pitching. And it was really interesting to see that in the college setting. We talked to a couple of students after class, and one of the people that we talked to, his name was Fez Khan. And he doesn't come from Phoenix, but he compared Phoenix a little bit to his actual home.
I mean, I'm from Silicon Valley, so it's obviously pretty big there, and I'm from that culture. So coming here and seeing people develop technologies and new things, it's kind of like seeing another Silicon Valley starting to develop in Phoenix. So it's really cool.
So let's say this succeeds, right? And there are little tech hubs in all these different places. Mm. What happens then? Do we see some of the problems of Silicon Valley just play out in other places, or spin forward 50 years and then all the tech jobs go away and someone tries to figure out the new thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to predict the future, right? But, you know, for one, I would say, you know, Silicon Valley has its name because it really was all about making chips, right?
Yeah.
And all of these different tech hubs are really different, you know, they're different places with different kinds of tech industries in them. So I don't think we're going to see sort of carbon copies in that way. But the right real estate is key for aspiring tech hubs, and old factories and warehouses are really being filled up by startups all over the country. I don't think we're going to see tech hubs become the new manufacturing towns necessarily, but are startups around the country comparable to the Industrial Revolution, what's happening right now in this space? There has to be a bunch of doctoral theses out on that already, Lizzie, and probably many more.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our Codebreaker podcast, thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Let's stay with tech now. I don't know if any of you have seen a horror movie called The Belko Experiment.
Stage one, commence.
His head exploded from the inside. What?
When we start working here, they put tracers in the back of our heads.
You must not remove the tag from your body. Follow our directives, or we will detonate the explosive. Begin.
What you heard was a group of corporate employees held captive in a building and ordered by that ominous voice to start killing each other. If they ignore the orders, the bad guy will detonate microchips implanted in the back of their heads as a sort of employee ID. So, okay, that is a terrifying plot. But the idea of a company microchipping its employees is not as futuristic as it sounds. There's a Swedish company doing it, and American ones are looking at it too. April Glazer is a reporter for Recode, and she wrote a story about this. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I think my first question about the idea of a microchip under my skin is, what? Ah!
Yeah, it's pretty disturbing. It kind of, the idea is to turn you into a cyborg in a way. And that's what the people who are doing this are saying, is that this is kind of taking the Internet of Things into the Internet of Us. These chips are supposed to allow you to communicate wirelessly with the world around you. So open a door as opposed to taking out a key card or a key fob, to unlock your computer or your phone for security reasons, maybe even to communicate with Internet of Things devices like a coffee maker in your home.
How likely is it that, say, a big company could start microchipping its employees to find out when they're in the office, when they're out of the office?
Well, in Sweden, we've already seen some companies doing this. A startup hub is doing it in Sweden now, and they have over 100 of their people that work in their building now have been microchipped, or chipped, as they call it, to get in the door or to access things or buy things in the facilities. If a company wants to do it and if enough employees are down, then it certainly could happen. The technology is there, and there's no reason why a group of consenting adults couldn't do it.
It seems like there are a whole range of different concerns, from just basic privacy concerns, the creepy factor, and then the idea of the potential that our bodies could be hacked.
Sure. So anything that can, any device that can communicate with another device, or that's connected to the internet, or that's transmitting information in some way, could be hacked. And we see this happening, you know, every week. It's hard to find a headline that doesn't talk about some system or some device or some Internet of Things gadget getting hacked. But particularly with medical devices, it's a concern. And the FDA has issued warnings about, you know, the pacemakers before, or about drug infusion pumps that are vulnerable or have security vulnerabilities that can be disabled remotely or changed the way they operate in some way, you know, outside of the way they've been originally programmed, that could be deadly. So, you know, medical devices do pose an extreme threat when it comes to being hacked. And these chips, you know, could potentially be hacked. And although they, at the moment, they don't seem to be containing that much information, more like how to, you know, open a door or the information that to unlock your computer or your phone, they are inside of you. So they do know when you enter a building and when you leave a building, how long you're there, right? When you decide to unlock your computer, all of these things enable a hacker to paint a very precise picture of your whereabouts. And that's concerning.
You wrote about Microsoft inviting this Swedish company Biohacks to its Tech Days conference, and, you know, that they implanted some of these chips in speakers. When you look at big companies like a Microsoft, or, say, you know, someone like Elon Musk,
Do you see this kind of technology spreading to big and mainstream consumer companies over the next few years?
Well, they might make it available to their workers, but, you know, I think there's always going to be a level of consent involved, and there'll have to be. So if people want this, if they want to be, you know, even more closely tied to the machines in the digital world, then, you know, we could see larger companies offering this. But, you know, I think a lot of workers will have reservations before diving in.
Yeah. I mean, this sort of takes me back to the idea of the Internet of Things, which we've talked about a lot on this show before. And, you know, do you want your fridge talking to your microwave? And I guess it's really the same concern. Do you want the tiny microchip in the palm of your hand talking to some larger system that tracks your comings and goings?
You know, there's a conversation about convenience and autonomy here, right? Is it really worth the convenience of waving my hand in front of a door as opposed to taking out a key card that is not, you know, completely tied to my body? You know, is it really worth the convenience of waving my hand in front of my coffee maker to turn it on as opposed to moving my finger 2 inches in front of it and pressing a button? So, you know, if people want it and they're very inspired by this idea, then perhaps they might want to be on the bleeding edge of technology in that way. But the uses right now might not be completely compelling for a lot of people.
April Glazer, reporter at Recode, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Next week, we're going to stick with the future of work. Are job interviews a waste of time? We'll tell you once you reveal your greatest strength and weakness. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. And this weekend, millions of Christians around the world are celebrating Easter. And there are movie studios that would like you to do a little of that at a theater. In recent years, there's been a big increase in films that are marketed toward faith-based audiences. Marketplace's entertainment correspondent, Adrian Hill, is here to explain. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Lizzie.
It's nice to see you in person.
I know. It's exciting.
Tell me a little bit about the history of faith-based films, I guess, in our modern understanding of them.
Yeah, so the modern history starts with Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. Okay. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with this. This was self-financed by Mel Gibson and a couple of investors. It ended up making $600 million, more than that.
Wow.
And it really opened the eyes of Hollywood and other big studios to the fact that there is an audience out there, a faith-based audience, that wants these kind of stories. I mean, in the last, like, 20 years, we've seen a huge increase in the number of movies coming out with strong Christian content.
Do these movies do well? You mentioned The Passion of the Christ and their box office. Are these films successful?
Sometimes they are. I mean, it's like any other movie, right? You don't quite know if it's going to work until it works.
Right.
But we have examples out there. One thing we've seen in the sort of more recent history is bigger stars getting involved. So Jennifer Garner,
yep,
you might be familiar with from some of these. She was in Miracles from Heaven. That pulled in about $74 million last year. Heaven is for Real with Greg Kinnear and Thomas Hayden Church. That crossed $100 million. And then you have these giant biblical epics. So you've got Noah, you have Exodus, you have a bomb like Ben-Hur, which made $94 million, but cost more than that. One thing I love about Ben-Hur, I don't know if you saw it. This is the 2016
No,
Ben-Hur.
I've seen the old one.
Yes. No, the 2016 was described in some places as Jesus meets Fast and Furious.
That seems like a tough combo to pull off.
Yeah, fair enough.
Okay, so what about today? What about now?
You know, I asked Ray Nutt this question, and he's from Regal Cinemas.
And I think the definition of faith-based has actually evolved over the years. It's not just, you know, evangelical content. It's also family-oriented films that I think the faith-based groups out there look for to take their families to.
So here's what's interesting. This weekend, right now, there is a film out called The Case for Christ. This is based on a best-selling book by an author named Lee Strobel. It's about a sort of atheist journalist coming to Christ, finding belief. And its competition, which is fascinating, Lizzie, is the Smurfs movie.
as a faith-based film, The Smurfs?
So here's what's interesting. The Smurfs is out from Sony. It was always intended as a general family audience movie, but Sony has a faith-based arm called Affirm Films. They took a look at this movie and they said, hey, this has a lot of faith elements. So they started marketing it as a very faith-friendly movie.
Wow.
And they pulled out Bible verses. There's a study guide you can look at. And The Smurfs has become sort of competition in some ways to The Case for Christ, which is really interesting. I asked Ted Baer about where this faith-based film market is going next. He's the publisher of Movie Guide, which tracks and reviews Christian films. He says the faith-based audience is a lot like the broader audience.
Because people want either big action adventure or humor. So I guess what we have to do with the faith-based movies is get more humor in it.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that if you can figure out how to combine what we all want as people, which is to go to the movies and have a good time, with what this faith-based audience wants, you could have a hit on your hands.
As we think about the definition of faith-based expanding a little bit, are the studios looking at that as a new market, or are they thinking, oh, we can kind of manage to get our content to satisfy both camps, you know, a more secular camp and a faith-based camp? Or do they really think of it as different creatures?
No, I think they think of it as very, I mean, I think that the goal here is to come up with films that appeal to both audiences simultaneously, right? One really interesting word that one of the heads of Affirm Films used was lenticular marketing.
What does that mean?
So lenticular is, do you remember those things as a kid? Those, like, maybe they're Valentines or toys, pieces of paper. And if you turned it one way, it looked like this. And if you turned it this way, it looked like this. It's like, for faith-based films, it's all about sort of lenticular marketing. So that you might see an uplifting story about a family, and somebody else might see a story about the power of prayer. And so those films ideally can sort of be rolled into one and appeal to lots of different parts of the audience.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
And that's our show for this week. Before we go, here's one last air travel horror story from a listener.
One time, a reporter named Lizzie O'Leary reassured me via Twitter about flying Delta. 3 days later, I got stranded in Detroit when my final destination was 3 hours away due to a freak fire at the Detroit airport. So thanks a lot for that one, Lizzie.
You're welcome. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman, Eliza Mills, Dan Semitovich, and Joanne Griffith, with help from Danielle Stevens. This is the last week of Danielle's internship, so thank you for all your great work and congratulations on the start of an amazing career. Watch out, world, she is coming for you. Brian Allison and Bill Lance are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Norin Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.